This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Well, welcome to the last session for today. It's a great pleasure to welcome our last panel of six people who each individually have contributed personally and can reflect personally on participating in shaping the National Historical Collection. I was trying to think of a collective noun that we could apply to this group of gentlemen, and I must admit I sort of failed in that. Maybe that'll be the competition for the end of the day. Thought bevy, but then, you know, bathing beauties came up, which wasn't really appropriate. We're actually going to go a little bit chronologically this afternoon, moving from the mid-70s right through up until the museum's opening in 2001. Each panellist is going to talk for about 5 or 6 minutes, reflecting on their own experience with the museum and with building the National Historical Collection, but also, I hope, looking forward to the future of the museum and of the NHC. And I hope afterwards we'll have some time for discussion that will take us in that direction. It's my pleasure to introduce first Professor John Mulvaney, one of Australia's perhaps most eminent archaeologists. He was a member of the Committee of Inquiry on Museums and National Collections in 1974-75, which produced the Pickett Report, about which we've heard quite a bit today already. And he was chair of the Planning Committee for the Gallery of Aboriginal Australia, which was part of that process. He's really been involved with the museum in many different capacities since that time, so it's a great pleasure to welcome him this afternoon.
Well, as an old-timer, I thought I'd better talk about the old times. Firstly, the Institute of Anatomy. Somewhere around 1974, people began to object to the fact that there was, in the section on human evolution, there was a gorilla skull, an Aboriginal skull, and a European skull, in that order. So I went and lodged a complaint about it. So all they did, they went to the display and picked the European skull and the Aboriginal skull and reversed them. So human evolution is as simple as all that. When I was still in Melbourne before I came up here, I was involved with Helen Groger Firm in valuing two of the, well, certainly the Wishart stone tool collection and I think the Mitchell collection, but the records might rule that out. But we valued the Wishart collection, and I think we valued it at £4,000. This was for the Australian Institute of Aboriginal Studies, and at that stage, it was in an interim stage, with Fred McCarthy was the sort of interim director. And he objected most strongly that any stone tool collection could be valued at £4,000. That was going to overvalue everything throughout Australia. Well, look what it did. There was an interim period. Well, there have been a lot of interim periods with this museum, but there was one between the Pickett Report in 76 and the interim council in 81. And somewhere or other, there was an unofficial collections committee established. Dr. David Ride, the biologist, was on it, Barry Smith, the historian, and myself. I don't think there were anyone else, but we answered to Peter Ryan, who at that stage was the bureaucrat in charge of the very small museum section. And there were several things came up for sale or gift. Gifts were all right. We had no money. And there were a couple of notable things that I've just mentioned. The Batman deed, which is on display, I heard about it, that it was coming up for sale, and I contacted Robert Edwards, who at that stage was the executive officer of the Aboriginal Arts Board, and he immediately found a person who would finance it, and that's how the museum got it, by word of mouth like that. The other one is the Le Swiff collection of miniature Victorian tools, also on display. That came about because the ANU awarded Norman Tyndale an honorary doctorate in 1980, and he invited his friend Le Swiff to attend the ceremony. We then invited them all down for dinner to our house, and over dinner he said he had these miniature collections, and that's how the museum has them. My time being fairly short, may I just say that the other notable enterprise that I was involved in when I was on the interim council was when we went up to Darwin and we went out into the mangrove swamps where the Vietnamese boat people were still coming in. And we decided we should have a Vietnamese boat. And we selected a Vietnamese boat in the mangroves, and eventually I think the army brought it down. And it's somewhere, I suppose, in Mitchell. And I just wish to register how ludicrous it was to build this museum totally without regard to the prize exhibits that should be exhibited here. That Vietnamese boat represents one of the most significant moments in 20th century Australian history, and yet it can't be displayed because there's no room. Just in case I sound too radical, may I say that Bob Menzies' vehicle, I've forgotten what brand it is,
a Bentley,
is can't be displayed either. And I think this was the great tragedy of this museum. It has all sorts of facilities, but the one facility it doesn't have is exhibition space, which makes it a contradiction in terms. Thank you.
Excellent. I can see we're going to have a good conversation this afternoon. when I first arrived at the museum, I kept on hearing about this thing called the Pickett Report, and it's a very great pleasure to welcome the man himself, whose name sits on that report, Mr. Peter Pickett, who was chair of the advisory committee in 1974-75. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you, Kirsty. Really appreciate being here, and 31 years later, people didn't really expect to see John Mulvaney and I still around. Maybe that the government will take an idea that we shouldn't appoint people who are young enough to be around 31 years later to criticise and haunt us, but we're here and we're still standing, some of the few that are still standing. But I'm going to tell you that I'm not going to talk about collections because that's not my bailiwick. That's better done by all these experts around me here today. And this might be my last chance to talk to you about the future, because I think the future is really important. And before I do so, let me say that I'm in awe of what has been done today to date under the circumstances that could be so much better. And my admiration and congratulations extends to all now working in this museum, and to Dawn Casey, who took a shapeless mass and turned it into a museum. I often quote my visit to Dylan Ripley in 1974, who ran the Smithsonian Institution. When I explained to him what our plans were for the siting of a museum on broad acres, he applauded our vision. He told me no museum had been built in the last 100 years that was not inadequate by the time it opened. He warned me to be prepared for the stealth of bureaucratic interference and to hold true to our ideals. Time proved him to be correct in his predictions. On page 79 of our report, we said, "We stress a lesson painfully learned by many museum administrators in citing a museum. We must keep in mind the following decades. A living museum will never be completed. Successive generations must have the opportunity to alter and add. The Service Committee," and if you know who they were, the Jim Service Committee, "ignored this warning. It's hard to get people to look beyond their own lifetime, even harder to get politicians to look beyond the next election. So now we suffer from the limitations of dimension. This site has diminished our vision for the museum. The service report shrank the display area to fit the Acton site. Instead of a site for a museum, we have an inadequate museum to fit a site. Our curators are separated from their collections, something that we warned about in our report. They are 10 kilometres away at Mitchell, which is now 90% full, and completely taken away the possibility of future expansion to meet both display and collection requirements in the future. This is being caused by a lack of vision to recognise future requirements and a lack of political will to take on the bureaucrats and the politicians. My committee recommended at least 90 hectares. Yarramundi was not on the table at that stage. However, when the interim council, which I was on, was offered it, we jumped at the opportunity of securing the 88-hectare site, a site protected by the Museum Act of 1980. What we now have in most aspects is the 10% museum. The site at Acton is a little more than 10% of Yarramundi. The exhibition spaces are a mere 10% of what my committee recommended, and it is not possible to achieve our other recommendations. I have worried about what we would do with this site if we could move the museum to Yarramundi. In a discussion with my very old friend and John's friend, Professor David Ride, who has demonstrated in many academic spheres great ability to think outside the square, he said to me, "Pete, we could turn it into an introduction to the National Museum." For those in a hurry, can, if you like, have a Clayton's Museum. So fascinating and intriguing that the casual visitor will make sure that they see the real thing at Yarramundi. Yarramundi still offers the opportunity to have indoor and outdoor spaces of the magnitude that my committee envisaged. The opportunity for school children from distant parts of Australia to stay on the museum site with their teachers. We would have the opportunity of imaginative displays showing Aboriginal history outdoors instead of completely in a concrete jungle, and a wonderful displays of early European life together with living fauna. It was evident to me on the opening day that in spite of the deficiencies of size, this would be a popular museum, something the designers of the car park obviously did not believe. More than 700,000 people went through this museum last year. Dylan Ripley told me that visitation gave him political influence. People love the Smithsonian. 9 million a year tramp through the Air and Space Museum. The politicians know the visitation rates of all the Smithsonian museums and would not dare cut back on expansion. In the 31 years since our report was tabled, Australia's population has increased by 8 million. 23% of Australians were born overseas, and ethnic diversity has exploded. Today, the nation has a surplus of $15 billion in taxes. It makes us wonder why we have one of the world's smallest national museums. With great credit to all who have worked and now work in this museum, they have proved that a truly national museum is wanted and appreciated by the public. We and the friends of the museum should lobby to keep Yarramundi or be doomed to lose it. It is only a matter of time when it is realised that the door has closed on this opportunity, and the consequence will be that the museum will be split in the future, as it cannot serve the nation as a national museum on this site indefinitely.
Thanks, Peter. I think that probably both John and Peter have already raised one of the themes that we could perhaps discuss afterwards, which is exactly one of the themes that has come up throughout the museum's history about the relationship between collections and exhibitions, and perhaps research should be the other one that goes in there, what the relationship should be between those three. We move on now to Dr. Don McMichael, who takes us forward really to the early 80s, I think, is his primary period of working with and for the museum. Don started off his working life as a curator of zoology at the Australian Museum, but in 1984 joined the National Museum as its first director and served in that post for 5 years, is that correct? Until 1989. Thanks, Don.
Thanks, Kirsten. Well, I'm not going to buy into the question about location, but I do think that it's important for everyone to realise that in 1984, the staff and council of the National Museum was utterly persuaded and believed that the museum would be built at Yarramundi along the lines of and in the scale envisaged by Peter Pickett's committee. And this, of course, had some significant impact on the collections approach that we took at that time. I might say that it may be difficult for a lot of the younger people here today to conceive what it was like to arrive in February 1984 as director of a National Museum with half a dozen staff, no buildings, no money, no collection, and a council of people, all well-intentioned, but with only a couple of them with any experience of a museum in practice. It was quite a challenging time. Nevertheless, we got busy with the job of developing collections because we did have at least some guidance. We had the guidance of the Act itself, which specifies the broad themes of the museum, and we had the guidance of the reports of the Pickett Committee and of the Interim Council, which had built up concepts of how the museum might be developed, and these were at least something to work on. Well, we were confronted with several really significant tasks right at the beginning. The first was alluded to earlier this morning, and that was the task of assembling those elements of the National Collection, or the building, putting together the National Historical Collection from the elements already under the control of the Commonwealth agencies and departments, including the National Ethnographic Collection and the small collection of objects which John Mulvaney mentioned held by the Department of Home Affairs and some other departments. This wasn't always easy. You know, bureaucrats are notorious about hanging on to power, and many of them had sort of built up the departmental collections over time and carefully preserved them. But when the time came to hand them over, they were loath to do so, and you can understand why. Here were they being asked to give them to a museum with no facilities, no conservators, and no money to look after them. But nevertheless, over time that was achieved, and so bit by bit the collections began to come together. National Capital Development Commission provided us with a store at Mitchell. We began to recruit staff and conservators, and so the capacity of the museum to actually deal with collections grew steadily over those early years. The second set of imperatives, apart from gathering together what belonged to us, was to begin to build collections for both the permanent displays that would be at Yarramundi and for the visitor centre, which was to open within a year or so. The council at the time was still of the view that they could build and open the museum by 1990, so 6 years was not long to assemble a national collection on the scale that was envisaged by the people who had been thinking about the museum for some years. We had an enormous challenge to put together a collection of appropriate, important material worthy of a national collection, and significantly, and that could be, could make a significant set of displays for those opening exhibitions. The visitor centre was to open in 1986, and the council was quite concerned that the display of materials put on there should itself be of a high quality and representative of what might be in the future museum. It was seen to be very important to get that right. So this is driving at all times our ideas about what we should try to bring into the collection. We set about it in a systematic way, first from the very earliest days beginning to develop an acquisitions policy, and that was greatly assisted by the recruitment of professional curators like Gay Sculthorpe, Andrew Reeves, David Corse joined the staff from the Institute of Anatomy. We started to build a body of people with knowledge of collections and collection building and collections management, and put together an acquisitions policy, which I'm pleased to see is still largely reflected in the sorts of topics which are in the forward program of the National Museum, which we saw earlier on. We didn't have much money, but we began to get a little bit to acquire things, and sometimes at auction, sometimes through private treaty, and we began to get offered quite a lot of material. Just, however, I don't have time to go into great detail, but I'd like to say a few things about collecting for a museum. It seems to me that it's for a museum of social history, so much depends on chance opportunities. John Mulvaney actually mentioned a couple of instances of how things were acquired for the National Historical Collection through happenstance, through his conversing with someone over dinner. That's not unusual, and an example of that is actually where we got the Enterprise. It so happened that I attended a Museums Australia annual conference in Ballarat, and found myself sitting at dinner with a group of steam enthusiasts from Echuca. And over the course of the evening, they extolled the virtues of paddle steamers and made me persuaded that this was something of great historical significance, and not only that, that there were very few of them left. And so on returning to Canberra, I put it to the Museum Council we should set about looking for a paddle steamer. And they agreed, set a limit on the price that we might pay, and eventually we found and located the Enterprise and purchased it, and eventually had it restored, and I think everyone would agree now that it's a priceless part of the museum's collections. But these things do sometimes happen by chance, albeit within a framework of a broad acquisitions policy which makes sense in historical terms. John's mentioned the Hong Hai. I mean, that's another example of a really significant item which was acquired with specific social history purposes in mind. I very much regret that it's not now available. I must say I don't know where it is. Is it? Does anyone know if it is at Mitchell? Yes, it was. Well, fortunately, of course, it did provide, and the important thing, it provided the focus for documenting the history of many of the people who arrived in Australia on it, and that was itself an important aspect of the question. Let me conclude by just saying a bit about Australia too. This is the only example I know of where politics intruded into the collections of the National Museum. In 1983, as you'll all recall, Australia won the America's Cup through Australia too, and it created a great deal of national interest. Alan Bond, the entrepreneur and sometime crook, decided that he needed more money to fund the next campaign to defend the cup, and so he approached the Commonwealth Government with a proposal that they should buy Australia 2 from him for about $1.3 million, as I recall, or he would sell it to the Italians. I might say that the Minister for Finance at the time was John Dawkins, who also happened to be the member for Fremantle, where both Australia 2 and the 1987 Cup Defence Syndicate was located. So there was some enthusiasm on the part of the government and Dawkins to see that the boat didn't go to Italy, and he asked the museum if it would be interested in acquiring it. The council considered this and said, well, look, yeah, it's a great object and we'd love to have it, but we don't have any money, so if you'll provide extra funds, we'll take it into the National Historical Collection. And that's, in fact, what happened. Now, the decision to acquire the boat and bring it to the East Coast for the National Museum after it completed its trial horse duties for the 1987 Cup defence provoked intense antagonism from Western Australians. It was considered by them that the boat belonged in Western Australia because that's where it went. Of course, it was important to the nation as a whole, and we took a contrary view. The matter became complicated because at the same time the Australian National Maritime Museum was being developed, and eventually, after some consideration, went its separate way. And so it was decided to transfer the boat to the National Maritime Museum in Sydney, and in fact the building of the National Maritime Museum were designed specifically to provide for the display of Australia too. Needless to say, the West Australians persisted, and as the passage of time and a weak national government, the boat was eventually transferred back to Western Australia, which in my mind is disgraceful. Anyway, those are just a few thoughts from me. They illustrate some of the interesting things we had to deal with in those first 5 years. And I must say I'm very impressed personally with the way that the museum has developed in terms of its approach to collection building and the intellectual effort that people like the speakers today and all of you people are putting into how collections should be acquired and the basis for museums to function. So thank you for listening to me.
Thanks, Don. I think it's pretty clear from our discussion so far that each curator at the National Museum should receive each year a considerable amount of money to take interesting people out to dinner, don't you think? Frieda's up there somewhere, aren't you? Well, to get a curatorial perspective on that proposition, it's very nice to welcome Andrew Reeves. He's a historian and who was the first social history curator at the National Museum, working here in that capacity from 1984 to 1986. And then he returned in a completely different guise to be a member of Museum Council for 6 years, meantime working also as the director of the WA Museum. So welcome, Andrew.
Thanks, Kirsten. Look, like others, I'm extremely pleased to be back here from my point of view, particularly in a context where collections, collection building and research are being talked about in the same breath. I think that rupture between those has gone on for far too long at this museum. It's wonderful to see it restored. I don't believe that that's the case in all museums around Australia. The Pigott Report clearly is a landmark document. I'd like to just go back a little step before that to 1958, which to me is the date that kicks off a round of museum redevelopment in Australia that's culminated in $2.5 billion spent on infrastructure and an equivalent, if not a larger amount, on salary, staffing, programs, the whole range of things. It was in 1958 that David Ride wrote the document that outlined how the Western Australian Museum was going to be taken from the early 19th century into the 20th century. I don't know how he convinced a government of the day to undertake that work. However, he did. And as one of the previous speakers has mentioned, about a decade later, the Western Australian Museum created the first social history department in any Australian museum. And Guy, while I'm sure the Museum of Victoria and the Powerhouse Museum have done a great deal in terms of social history, I really think the role of the Western Australian Museum, particularly David Hutchison and Jeff Bolton, needs to be acknowledged. They broke the trail, and indeed much of the work they've set in train is yet to be completed and certainly has not been overtaken in the relevance of the issues that they raised. Anyway, the Pigott Report consolidated the work set in train there, and a few years later, well, in fact a decade later after the museum was established, I came up from Melbourne to work for the museum. Ian spoke of collecting the Dalton collection, the printer from Echuca, reflecting a sense of confidence. Look, I was dead scared. There was no confidence about it because it's those who worked here in the 90s will know some of the sense of this. Those who have been around longer will, I'm sure, appreciate this. The National Museum was a contingent museum for longer than anyone cares to remember. I arrived from a stint at the University of Melbourne where I worked in the archives and having been involved in the creation of the Museum of Victoria, and I came with naive assumptions about funding, about collections and indeed about government support. Well, wasn't I in for a shock? The first conference I went to representing this museum was to, I think, the inaugural Museums Australia conference in Adelaide, where I sat down and heard the then South Australian Premier John Bannon call for the abolition of the National Museum and telling the then... Was it Barry Cohen, the minister, I suppose?
No, he
was the first Labor Arts Minister.
Oh, yes, if it was Labor, it was Cohen.
Yeah, it was Cohen, to his face, that the best thing they could do would be to abandon the museum, distribute the collections and get on with the job. And it didn't pass quickly either. Creative Nation, which was published, promulgated, I suppose, in 1994, was the most museum-unfriendly national cultural policy imaginable. It is, interestingly enough, the last national cultural policy promulgated by any government. But apart from the fact that that was the instrument by which Australia 2 was returned to Western Australia, much to my regret because I was over there by then, it also set in train what I think was probably the last big attempt to dissolve this museum. The ethnographic collections were on the verge of being transferred to South Australia at the behest of the South Australian Museum and a number of their proponents, and it took a lot of work by a lot of people, some here at the table and others, to actually ensure that Paul Keating's total disinterest in cultural institutions did not result in the abolition of this institution. And apropos that, Don Watson's Recollections of a Bleeding Heart, Don seemed to have a sort of bit of a mental blackout on occasion, and it would be rather nice for him to fill in the gaps on the discussions that took place in the Prime Minister's office about cultural policy and about this museum in particular, because that story is yet to be told. Can I interpolate very briefly there? It would be rather nice to see a spin-off from this conference, this workshop, where a bit of the museum interviews some of the people involved in these issues. And I don't simply mean people like us at this table. I'm talking about those who reflect both the cultural and the political environment in which the museum was finally created. Because there's both a public history and a hidden history, and both of those, I think, need to be preserved. I'll never forget the first day I went out. I actually think it was at Fishwick, where our first collection store was, where I was introduced to this thing called the National Historical Collection. Well, what a misnomer. National Antiquarian Collection, perhaps. Certainly not National Historical Collection. There was the odd gem or two, I remember, but mostly it was ramshackle buggies, bits and pieces of broken wheels, bits of unidentified iron, things that people basically said we can't throw out because they're in the National Historical Collection. I mention this because, for me, the context of collecting in the 1980s for this organisation was a race against time to establish legitimacy. First of all, in the eyes of our peers, of other museums, and there was no shortage of opposition on that front, but latterly, in the eyes of government, because to my personal regret, the Hawke and later Keating Labor governments were no friends of the National Museum. And in fact, Don might correct me on this, but I had the distinct impression that the museum being put on deferred building for some time, for years in fact, was due in part to the transfer of necessary funding to build a National Maritime Museum in Sydney as part of a deal cut by Bob Hawke with Neville Wran. There's a prelude to one interminable New South Wales election. Anyway, let me move on. My job was to build the collection and build it as rapidly as possible. Don's talked about acquisition policies. I won't rehearse those. There was inevitably a degree of opportunistic collecting. There was attending auctions, taking in donations and offers. All of that was true. But, look, can I add, Hong Hai seems to be the order of the day. Let me add my little Hong Hai story. I came along well after. I was the person sent up to Darwin to sort of do the final deal. And the council, interim council or council, either both of them have been up there and they believe that they had bought the boat. Well, the chap who lived out in the mangroves with the bloke, a bloke called Rabbit, had different ideas. And it wasn't until I added a slab of beer to the price that he agreed that the boat belonged to the National Museum, and it subsequently came south. Anyway, that's the Hong Hai. Mind you, in terms of the Hong Hai, isn't it interesting that massive immigration of people from Asia during the 1980s, I mean, the response of the Commonwealth is to agree to buy one of the boats and add it to the National Collection. 20 years later, you get a yellow peril scare and a national emergency on the basis of boat people. It's certainly a different age now to that when we started collecting that material. I think it was someone picked up on what I think is a particularly important point, and that is that rather than just buy odd objects or individual items, we sought to acquire complete intact collections, both to build the quality and the quantity of the collections, of the National Collection, I must confess. But I do think things like the Dalton Collection and the Lebovic postcard collection reflect that sort of approach that I was particularly pleased and enjoyed hearing about Springwood collection this afternoon. I think as a methodology, it's one that the National Museum needs to continue to use for this reason. The museum emerged, its historical collections emerged during that period, as Ian spoke of, where social history was in vogue and the new museology was sweeping the museum world. Now, other museums in Australia had a shortcut to historical collections. What they basically did was reinterpret their science and technology collections and call them historical collections. And given the sort of material that had been collected, that was possible. The National Museum didn't have that luxury and still doesn't. And so strategies such as collection as opposed to individual acquisition, I think, is particularly important. Can I just rehearse one or two things before I finish? The first of them is to refer you again, as Ian did, to that 1982 conference on museums and history. The papers at that conference bear reading today. I'd particularly refer you to the paper by David Hutchison and Jeff Bolton, which is the genesis in many ways of the museum's long-standing preoccupation and commitment to matters relating to migration and immigration. And as an aside, isn't it interesting? I don't know what it is about Western Australia, but in terms of Bolton, Hutchison, more recently Tom Stanage and Lenore Neyman, I can't think of another state that has produced so many historians who have made such a direct contribution towards museums. Let me finish off with just one point, and it's something I hadn't thought about, and I was quite interested to hear three people today so far refer to this concept of the distributed national collection. Now, I was a member of the Heritage Collections Working Group and Council that promoted that idea. I must say, I never saw it as an instrument to contain the National Museum. In quite the contrary, in fact, I think those wishing to contain the museum were elsewhere. In retrospect, I think the concept of the National Historical Collection is one that could be revisited by this museum now from a position of strength rather than perceived weakness. The Distributed National Collection, pardon me. And if I can sort of cross into politics just for a minute, it seems to me it could be one way for this museum to see some of the agenda back from the Federal Department of Information Technology and the Arts. If indeed this museum stood back from the Heritage Collections Working Group and the Distributed National Collection because it was seen as a threat, I think that's a great pity, because in the hands of the museum, I see it as one of its long-term guarantees of survival. Thank you.
Thanks, Andrew. I'm going to invite Luke Taylor to speak now. Dr. Luke Taylor is currently acting principal at IATSIS. He joined the NMA in 1990 as a curator, becoming then a senior curator, and prior to opening, worked together with senior curator John Mundine to develop what is now called the Gallery First Australians. Thanks, Luke.
Thanks very much, Kirsty. And since I've come over here from the Institute, I should just put in a plug for the Institute. We've heard a number of times today about the transfer of the object collections from the Institute of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Studies to this museum. But it's important to understand that those collections were put together as part of a research effort. The Institute runs a research grant program as a feature of that contract. For many years, we required the researchers to deposit the collections that they had made with the Institute. Now, the physical objects were transferred to the museum at a particular point in time, but it should be said that the manuscript material relating to the collection of those materials, the photographic collection, the film collection, the oral history collections, the music and the song, all that sort of material exists in the Institute archive today. And we've seen Howard today was very effectively able to show how material culture collections relate back to this sort of whole fabric of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander life. Well, it used to be one of my little hopes that the sort of the new digital realm would allow us to do the sort of easy search of both the National Museum collection and the Institute collection and reveal the connections between these materials that were otherwise sort of sundered, if you like. But it's actually not possible. It's not that simple. You do still have to do the research. Some of the major collections here, people like Fred McCarthy, those wonderful collections from Aurukun, Helen Verm, who's been mentioned a couple of times today, Carol Kupka, Howard Morphy himself was a research grantee who deposited some of the key artworks that he researched for his PhD with the Institute, and it's now in the National Museum collection. Fred Myers is another key collector. It's possible to research the activity of those individuals and construct a whole again. Not only that, the good research allows you to go back to the communities and reinvigorate the sort of life of those collections with the community. And I think this organisation's been able to do that very good effect, both for the opening exhibitions, where we were able, I think Amanda Reynolds was able to look at the McCarthy collection of Aurukun sculptures and go back to Aurukun and talk to WIC people, not only to use the archival materials that were in the Institute, but also to develop a new relationship which allowed her to talk about new issues. For example, the High Court was considering the issue of to what extent the granting of cattle station leases impacted on the extinguishment of native title. So a collection made in the early 60s provided the context for going back to the community and talking about new themes, investing the artefacts with new associations and providing an occasion to address new topics. Similarly, there was a ROM exhibition. We were talking about the distributed national collection. Well, we were able to do a very interesting exhibition between the National Library of Australia, which had the poignant photographs that relating to the ROM exhibition performance for Poignant in Maningrida in the late 50s. Also working with people at ANU, Kim McKenzie, Les Hyatt, who had done lots of work with that community, and also putting together collections from the National Museum. And that was able to put together a really interesting travelling exhibition that brought those materials together again. So just a little plug for research collections, I guess, and the good research providing documentation which allows us to reinvest those collections with life. Actually, when I came to the museum, we didn't have an acquisitions budget. That was in 1990. The museum was going through many phases. And we were looking for an opportunity to go back to government and argue, the council in particular, to argue for the reinvestiture of an acquisition budget. And one of the collections we came across was actually offered to us by Lord McAlpine. It was 40 boards painted by a man called Paddy Jumanji. They were ceremonial boards that were carried behind the head of the dancers for the grill-grill ceremony, the grill-grill ceremony. That was the dream by Rover Thomas that he had of the spirit journey of one of his relatives across the Kimberley. And the finale of the ceremony relates to the Cyclone Tracy hitting Darwin. Now, here was a collection offered to us. It was 40 boards. This was the original ceremonial set of boards which went on to inspire a whole art movement in the Kimberley. There are 40 boards offered to us for $40,000. And we didn't have an acquisition budget, but it was actually a really good wedge to go back to government and say, listen, this is absolutely critical. And the way we justified it was not just that it was important to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander culture within the organisation, but it was important to those people who were interested in examining the relationship between people and the environment. When we went into it, we found there was really good documentation of this collection by a man called Will Christensen, who actually documented the songs and how each of those boards related to a particular song that located the board in the Kimberley landscape. Similarly, we're so people who are interested in the environment, we were using the Pickett Report and the importance of the three themes and the interrelation of the three themes, the connection between them, not the separation, as a way of justifying that we could interpret this from the environmental theme, from the Indigenous theme, and indeed from the Australian social history theme, because here were things that not only did it relate to Cyclone Tracy, but also the development of a huge market for art, and indeed McAlpine's support of this in its early days, particularly in WA. So at a certain point in this exercise, going back to government, you get a call from, it was Daryl McIntyre, who's in the department, who's sort of just checking, are they really important? Having put all the documentation together, yes, we did have to convince the department they were indeed important, and they did supply the $40,000 to collect those works. But later, very soon after that, we were able to justify the reintroduction of an acquisition budget. And I should end soon, but we were able to commence a period of sort of targeted collecting without the pressures of having to develop exhibitions for a major opening day. We're actually able to sit down, look at the collection, think about both regional ellipses and thematic ellipses in the existing collection, and start some targeted field collecting work. And so I think mention was made before that there were very few artefacts from Torres Strait Island. This was Betty Meehan was looking after the section in those days, but both David Corse and Laurie Richardson were able to go and do some collecting work in the Torres Strait Islands. I went with Lorraine Coutts down to Tasmania to do some collecting work. And we started some relationships. I have to say, people were very nervous about working with museum to sort of hand over their culture. There was a lot of work had to go into sort of trying to smooth over that activity, discuss it through, and I note some of those same people that we talked to 15 years ago are still involved with the organisation today. So staff today have been able to go back to some of those same people and develop those collections. Similarly, we're able to commence more work in acquiring women's collections and contact history, which is obviously the huge underdeveloped area, perhaps, of the existing collections. The experience of Aboriginal people in contact history, that sort of intercultural experience. So, I mean, I would... Now that you've got through opening day, I can only advocate that it would be a great opportunity to go back to a bit of decent field collecting. Okay, thank
you. Thanks, Luke. And finally, it's a very great pleasure to welcome Dr. Richard Baker. Richard is currently the Associate Dean of the Science Faculty up at ANU and Head of the Geography Program. However, between 1989 and 1993, he was here at the museum. He was the inaugural curator setting up the what is now called People and the Environment. In fact, I think came up with the term. Welcome, Richard.
Thanks, Kirsten. So I'd like to do two things in my 5 minutes, if I could. One's just to chart the context for the establishment of that People and Environment Gallery. And the second is to talk about the collecting context, which Luke has just outlined to a degree that we didn't have a budget. So I actually started a month before Luke, I think, in late 1989. It was a very exciting period, and we were driven by the vision of the Pickett Report and the Interim Council, people like John Mulvaney. And there was an extraordinary excitement related mainly to the Yarramundi site. So I didn't know that I confess I didn't check who I was speaking with, so I didn't know I was going to be speaking with John and Peter, but it's a great honour to be here with them, because we were driven by the excitement of the Pickett Report and the Interim Council's imaginative interpretation of that. And there was a very strong focus, as we've heard today, on the Pickett Report in terms of integration, and the theme of the human interaction, the environment, played a core part of that. So our focus in terms of collecting was trying to realise the Pickett Mulvaney Interim Council vision of people and environment playing an important role in integrating human nature themes, not divorcing people from nature and then putting Indigenous people out there with nature. And that made the museum very, very different. There was a real focus on outdoor displays. That wasn't a new thing, so going back through the museum records, I was struck by how long that theme had been there. So, for example, in 1965, every sort of prominent biologist, environmentalist in Canberra and Australia at the time wrote a paper to the then Prime Minister arguing for the establishment of a biological centre in Canberra, proposing 200 acres. And with, on the basic conviction that a better understanding of our biological environment or our own biological nature in our place was vital. It's absolute necessity for the future and well-being of mankind. And, so, and this, interesting, was the same year that Stanner wrote his influential letter to the Canberra Times arguing for a gallery of Southern Man, which again talked about large areas of open space. The Pickett Report, as I said, had this thing of making the human interaction environment a central theme and stressed the importance of outdoor display. So the Interim Council talked about how the museum needed to be established on an extensive tract of land where views and open-air displays would be fundamental to the overall concept and as important as the objects viewed from within the museum buildings. The National Museum will be significantly different from other Australian museums of similar stature in the extent to which these outdoor displays... which it uses outdoor displays integrally with and not as adjuncts to internal displays. So our focus was very much on that. I've written a paper a long time ago, which I'm happy to send anyone, which I gave to the 1992 Karma Conference on the origin of the environment theme, and it's a sort of historical piece in itself now, but the council was influenced by Scandinavian museums, as understood it, in terms of museums that are interpreting outdoor landscapes, in terms of some art museums, which had this indoor-outdoor thing working well. And in turn, I was quite inspired with some of the outstanding Canadian museums, places like Head Smashed in Buffalo Jump in Alberta, which uses the landscape as part of the museum, and also places like the Manitoba Museum of Man and Nature and the Canadian Museum of Nature in Ottawa. So there's this excitement around the world, and visiting those places, ironically, all after I finished working here, they all talked about the Pickett Report as an inspiration for them and were asking me how was the museum going in Canberra, so I had very sad news for them in the early 90s because not much was happening there. So in terms of arriving, in terms of collecting themes, our focus was on the site. And I attempted to treat, and soon after I was appointed, Ruth Lane started as the second member of staff, and she and I felt quite strongly that we needed to move away from our titles, which are fairly grandiose, of curator for the Australian environment and assistant curator for the Australian environment. And we wanted to reflect the Pickett Report, so we convinced the council it should be changed to people and the environment to stress that interaction. And the council member responsible was Mike Archer, who was a biologist, but very sympathetic to that theme on interaction and conservation. So we talked about the landscape as a text, as an object, so related quite interestingly to Matt's talk this morning about objects having different meanings over time, and we talked about the landscape being an object that we needed to interpret. And the Aramundi site was an extraordinary site for that. I think when it was selected, it was described as a typical Australian landscape, and I think they meant in terms of rolling hills and sheep paddocks, but it was actually typical just by how much had been altered by a long history of Indigenous use. There was lots of archaeological sites there, but also by a long pastoral history. And the more I researched the site, the more interesting things came in terms of the capacity to interpret that site. Don't have much time, but just one was rabbits, long history of rabbits causing problems there and of them being harvested. So we started collecting materials of rabbits, and this relates to our lack of budget at the time. Our strategy was to have a small display at the Canberra Show, which led to publicity, which led to more donations from places like CSIRO, which led to more publicity on things like this, both the 7/3 report and Australia All Day, which led to more material being given to us. The other interesting thing, I think, about the Yarramundi site was its connection with the Murray-Darling Basin, which was our major exhibition at the time, and the fact that Australians and people in Canberra in particular, I think, are environmentally illiterate about which basin they live in. So I see this museum and having an enormous potential to address that, and the Yarramundi site would have been much better to do that than this site, but I'm sure it's still possible here. But as a nation, I think our environmental literacy has actually gone downhill quite dramatically over the last 20, 30 years. I teach a large first-year ANU geography course each year, and if you're just asking is Canberra in the Murray-Darling Basin, about 10% of people can tell you it is. It's actually the biggest city by a factor of three or four. I remember at an early conference at the museum being attacked for having the enterprise and taking it out of the Murray-Darling Basin, which was quite an interesting statement given that here it was in the biggest city in the Murray-Darling Basin. and that was by one of Australia's most prominent curators at the time. But it was quite a good example of how we're reinterpreting objects. So a paddle steamer, steam technology, but here it could be interpreted in terms of a long history of connections across people across the basin, and it was only during the paddle steam era that people in different parts of the basin knew they were connected. So another example of what we're trying to do. And maybe just briefly the last example of the targeted collection that Luke spoke about in 1992, our first sort of collecting priorities were contact history, women and backyards, and I was fortunate I could combine all three in terms of work. I'd recently finished my PhD on contact history in the Northern Territory community, but we employed a consultant to work on backyards, a wonderful report by Wendy Hucker, which hopefully is still in your files. But backyards was a strategic decision to focus on the site of most of our first interaction with the environment, and it wasn't the environment out there in the mythical untouched wilderness, it was the environment in the backyard where most Australians have their first contact with the environment. So the Hills Hoist collections, the Victor collections that I got for the museum were in the context of the plan to have 10 backyards of different eras built at Yarramundi and indoor-outdoor displays, but having the outdoor displays interpreting the Australian landscape. So I guess I'm out of time, I think.
Yep. Well, I've done my job extremely badly, and we have about 2 minutes left, but certainly enough time for a couple of questions, I think. If happy to open it to the floor. Oh, we do have a microphone too, so if people can run around, that would be good. And I can't actually see anything from here. Well, I'll open with a question. Oh, is the question up the back there? Louise. Yep, Louise.
Hi, Louise Douglas from the National Museum. Richard, the backyards idea I always thought was fantastically imaginative, but Keating just did not get it. I understand that that was one of the things that he heard about, particularly the Hills Hoists, that sent him running in the other direction. Do you remember that?
A long time ago. I haven't actually engaged with it since. I went through my files last night. There was a 3 or 4 week period in 93 where the director of the museum was pictured in the Weekend Australian hanging up nappies on a Hills Hoist. And then Hazel Hawke came out with a long article about backyards and how important they were, so maybe Keating was reacting to that. But I've got some overheads, I thought there might be an overhead projector, but and it was also during the Mabo debate, and backyards were very prominent in that. So backyards were on the paper and the front. And it's just a much, you know, wonderful vehicle for integration of themes. So I went back and looked at the origin. The first reported use of backyards in the Australian National Dictionary is from Tench in 1793, and it's Bennelong jumping out over a paling fence as soon as he got into a backyard. You know, so it's this wonderful, iconic part of Australian vocabulary and a space. But Keating didn't get it, and his vision was this monolith by the lake, which he said we shouldn't build. So that was very ironic in the sense he never got the outdoor displays because he had a very high culture view of what a museum was. And our failing, was that we couldn't get through to him, but maybe that was an impossible task.
I'd like to say I don't think Paul Keating should be blamed for the difficulties the museum was confronted with. I mean, Bob Hawke was the primary non-supporter of the museum. He was elected in 1983 with a specific platform, spoken at the Opera House in Sydney, "We will build the Museum of Australia," as it was called then. By 1986, he had backed right away from that altogether. And it was during that period from 1983 to 86 or 7 or 8, perhaps 5 years, that Hawke failed to grasp the opportunity that he could have done. And bear in mind that, you know, there were some years before the Keating era. So I think that the responsibility for non-progress with the museum lies equally with Hawke.
There's another burning question. I just perhaps wanted to finish with one question, which has a little bit been occurring to me all day, and which is actually also a bit of a Mike's plant question. One of the themes that I think has come out today, and also certainly through the panel, is the tension in the museum's collection between the serendipity that informs how different collections come to the museum versus perhaps what Luke was talking about, which is the opportunity for a much more considered and concerted process of targeted collecting, attempting to address what is seen as lacks in the collection. I guess what that makes me think about is the way in which the National Historical Collection comes to be an amalgam or a grouping together of lots of different kinds of collections, each of which come to the museum with their own sets of values and frameworks and kind of ideas that make sense of them. I just wanted to get sort of the panel's response to the question about whether you feel that is a problem, whether that makes a stronger collection, a more interesting collection, whether there are challenges that come with that, or indeed whether that's just, or indeed how we should just sort of think about managing that complexity of the of the, of the museum's collection. Anybody?
I think museums would be boring places without a serendipity factor. I think it's terribly important. Having said that, I couldn't agree more with Luke, that in as much as that focused, targeted collecting is critical. I mean, there are, as in so many things with museums, there are cycles we've got, we operate and work and live within. There are short-term collecting cycles, and the serendipity or auctions are one of those. There are long-term collecting cycles, and I often think that we could learn from medical research here and perhaps adopt something of the methodology of the longitudinal medical studies that have been going on in Australia, West Australia and Queensland, in some cases for up to 30 or 40 years. It means a long-term investment by museums in particular areas. I think the gains in terms of exhibitions, collections, community contact would be great. In terms of social history, it probably, as Don would say, more difficult to define a structured collecting policy when one doesn't have the taxonomy of the sciences or something else to use. Having said that, I think there are other structures or other methodologies that we can use in place of taxonomy in the social sciences. But, I mean, I'll finish where I began my comments. I think the sort of virtuous cycle of research, collecting and interpretation is the long-term strength of museums. It's why they've survived as cultural institutions over such a period of time. The tragedy is so many museums in Australia and internationally are, in fact, living off their accumulated intellectual capital. They're not replacing it at the same rate they're using it. This museum seems determined to break out of that, and I think it's terrific.
Well, we are officially out of time, unless there's... Oh, question up. Ian, is that you? Hiding behind the light?
I just want to ask probably something of a provocative question, actually. But it just sort of strikes me that we've got here a very esteemed group of people who spent enormous amounts of time and effort in delivering the vision of the Piggott Report. And the museum we've got today is very different from that vision. And I just wondered, what, when you actually look at the museum that's here today, are there aspects of it which are actually better than the Piggott vision? Or, you know, is it all just
downhill?
Downhill.
Who would like to pick up? Peter?
One of the 31 years, something the 31 years have done have made me quite deaf. But I heard that. No, look, I actually did hear your question, and I, as I said before, I am in awe of what has been done here at the museum under very difficult, I think, very difficult circumstances. And you've gathered in the museum marvellous curators who are doing a fantastic job. And, I mean, obviously, as we were just talking about outdoor displays, you can't do that. You don't have the room. I mean, we would have... We had people with great imagination on the committee, like Jeff Blaney, who would talk about we should bring to the people talk about Pangaea and Gondwana, and every hour we could have a map of the world and flood it every hour and show Pangaea and what happened to Gondwana and where Australia was in the Triassic period and where it moved to in the Jurassic. We can't do those things here, so, you know, I regret that, and many other things that we could do outside, but I think that we could probably do a lot better as far as the European occupation is concerned. But considering the constraints of size of this museum, I think you've done a fantastic job.
Could I make a brief comment too? And that is that the Piggott Report had a range of recommendations, of which the National Museum was but one. That it's realised now is terrific. what we still do not have is a mechanism to address on a national basis cultural issues of priority and urgency, be it called a museums commission, be it called anything else. What we've got are pale, short-term, underfunded, almost irrelevant organisations that cannot begin to cope with those issues. The work of the Pigott Report is unfinished.
I should just add, though, the thing that was a great success was the conservation. The government took very seriously our recommendations about the parlous state of conservation all over Australia in every institution. Unfortunately, the course that got going through that out at the Canberra University has been abandoned. I thought that was absolutely appalling, and I don't know why more people didn't protest about it in some way. However, I just like to really say that while we're saying this museum didn't meet the needs we saw, I think the effort done for conservation, and that was the Fraser government did that, was extremely fine.
Yes, I couldn't agree more with what John has to say. We had 400 graduates went through that course. All of them are employed, most of them in Australia, and it's a black mark on Australian history, and I wrote to Wendy McCarthy at the told her so. And the state of museums, I mean, little museum directors in Australia were presiding, doing little more but presiding over the steady deterioration of that which they were instituted to preserve when we went through the museums.
Well, I think it's my duty to draw the discussion to a close, unfortunately. Guy's just going to say a few concluding words, but I would like it if you just join me to thank the panellists for their contribution.
These are very short concluding words. One of the great things about today has been the participation of former staff, former members of council, former directors, former curators, and that's been really good because the museum, I think, as we've discovered today, is a lot of energy by a lot of different people over a long period of time. And in recognition of the people coming along today, I just wanted to pass along, there's one each. but they are collectors after all. And this is the catalogue from our most recent exhibition. So thank you very much to our panellists and all our speakers today. And I hope that this is the first in a number of conversations, forums, conferences that we have on the subject of collections. Thanks a lot.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.